Grace, mercy, and peace from the triune God be with you all. There we go. What a delight to have you all up on the stage here. This is great. Yay. Thanks for being here. You sounded wonderful up there. I guess I don't know if you can hear how you sound, but you sounded just gorgeous up there. So there's two rules for being up here on the stage. Curtis knows what they are. You have to stay awake, right? Yeah, you have to stay awake. And then you have to laugh at all of, even if the joke's really bad, you have to laugh and pretend that it's like really funny. Are you all with me? Okay. Thank you. I'll try to turn to you once in a while, so just to kind of keep you in it, okay? But thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it. Suzanne, thank you. So you heard the gospel reading this morning from John's gospel, right? You were listening? And if you weren't, I'm going to kind of go over it again in a minute. But the more that I study and the more that I try to live into the teachings of Jesus, the more I wish that there were some things that Jesus hadn't said, like, sell all you own, give to the poor, and follow me. I really wish that he hadn't said that one. If I had, you know, Thomas Jefferson went through the Bible and cut out the parts that he didn't like. If I had my Thomas Jefferson scissors, I would have cut out that verse. I know the gospel writers didn't get down everything that Jesus said, but couldn't they have left that one on the cutting floor? You probably won't ever see or hear a sermon series at University Church called The Easy Sayings of Jesus. None of them are easy. Love your enemies. Oh. Turn the other cheek. Really? Forgive, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. They're all hard. But we keep doing them, and we fail, and we dust ourselves off, and we try them again because we know that those are the things that make for peace, that make for compassion, that create community, even if most days they seem nearly impossible. But still, there are some things I wish Jesus had never said, like the one today. The poor you will always have with you. I wish he hadn't said it because hardly a week goes by that someone doesn't use that saying to support their opposition to any kind of program or any kind of service that would help someone in poverty. It's the theological shrug, right? I mean, why bother to do anything? You know, Jesus said that there will always be poor people, so it's just hopeless. On a Sunday when we're focusing on poverty and we're wondering, each one of us, I hope, is wondering, what is God calling me to do? It's worth pausing for a moment to ask, what in the world was Jesus thinking when he said, the poor you will always have with you? So the story. Back to the story. It takes place in a suburb, Bethany, a suburb of Jerusalem. Jesus is paying a visit. These are his dearest friends, Mary, Martha, and then Lazarus, who is recently awakened from death. At some point during the supper, Mary anoints Jesus' feet with perfume, which was a little bit unusual, and then she wipes his feet off with her hair, which is also highly unusual. The perfume is really expensive. A pound of this nard, it says, is worth about a year's wages. It's usually reserved for funerals to anoint a body for burial, right? It's an enormous luxury, and nobody who was there for that dinner was expecting what happened, that it would be poured out, the whole jar, all at once, on someone's feet. So when Mary did it, nobody knew what to say. You've been in those moments before, right, where something really unexpected and unusual happens and you're just like, I didn't know what to say. Well, it did catch the attention and the ire of the finance committee. Some of the disciples who were at the table who thought we could have put that money to good use, helping out various programs around in town. Jesus, who is the champion of the poor, dismisses Judas, and I assume there were others. Judas is always the scapegoat for these things, right? With those strange words that he just that we just read. You will always have the poor with you, but you won't always have me, so just leave her alone. How do you make sense of this? This is just the strangest thing. So one thing we know about Jesus, and really about all the writers of the Christian scriptures, is they were steeped in the Hebrew Bible. We call it the Old Testament. They knew their Bible, and those stories and sayings that to us make no sense often become clearer when we trace them back to their roots, to what those New Testament people were referring to. So Jesus is basically quoting a passage from Deuteronomy, and I want to share that with you. Deuteronomy is the fifth book in the Bible. Listen, this is what it says. Give liberally and be ungrudging when you do so. Did you hear that? Give liberally and be ungrudging when you do so. For on this account, Yahweh your God will bless you in all your work and in all that you undertake. Since there will never cease to be some in need on the earth, I therefore command you, open your hand to the poor and your neighbor in need in your land. That's the context. That's what's behind what Jesus is saying when he says, the poor you will always have with you. So, using that saying as a justification to neglect the poor is about as far away from the meaning of Jesus as you can get. The expectation is generosity. The expectation is that the poor will always be with us because the church, by its very nature and calling, will always be in ministry with the poor. Here's a more radical way of reading this. If you're not in ministry with the poor in some way, with those who are struggling with poverty and homelessness, if you're not in ministry with them, then you are not being the church. You with me? You're not being the church. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, said, "The measure of our Christian action, the way we measure ourselves, is not with our pious thoughts. It's not with our good intentions. But Wesley said it is concrete service to the poor." I read something from his diary the other day where John Wesley spent the entire day, winter day, going through melted snow that he said was up to his knees, begging for money for the poor. Yeah, he puts most of us who are Methodist pastors now pretty much to shame. I know. Wesley often said that the gospel would more readily take root among the poor than among the rich. He didn't have any illusions about the poor being more pious, but he knew the rich. He knew those who had things. And this is not exactly good news for us to hear this morning, right? But it's something that we need to be reminded of from time to time. This story is told in the other Gospels, and Jesus says that Mary's story will continue to be told wherever good news is proclaimed. Isn't it strange that what is most remembered about Mary's story are the words of Jesus? And what may be forgotten is the most important thing in all the story, that Mary had an expensive jar of perfume. And when Jesus came to visit her, she couldn't leave it over there bottled up. She had to go get it and bring it to Jesus and open it up. This wasn't going to be saved for some special day, but it would be offered up and poured out, emptied to the very last drop, spent lavishly, wasted on Jesus. Jesus is the poor whom we will always have with us. What Mary does for the disciples and for the whole church is it's like turning on a bright sign in the darkness, lighting up a path, pointing us down a different road toward passionate, wasteful acts of love. The great 20th century theologian Paul Tillich, who is oft quoted in this pulpit, wrote some of the densest, most complex theological theology. But he also wrote some beautiful, simple sermons. And the sermons were given in university chapels all over the country in the 40s and in the 50s. Paul Tillich. One of them is on this text. I read it this last week. It's called Holy Waste. Tillich begins by saying that Mary didn't waste anything at all. But a beautiful thing. But she did a beautiful thing because it came out of the abundance of her heart, out of the overflow of her love. And then Tillich takes kind of an interesting turn in his sermon. He says, there's a danger that religion will be, read the church, will be so reasonable, so calculated, that we will lose the beauty of wasteful self-surrender. Without the abundance of the heart, nothing great will happen. Calculating love, he says, is not love at all. Zing. Thank you, Dr. Tillich, for that reminder. So last week I caught a piece of an NPR interview. It was a young musician who confessed that every moment of her day was scheduled. She said, if you want to get with me, if you want to talk with me, I've got my calendar, but every moment, every hour of my day is scheduled. And I don't know, maybe there was a reason for that or a purpose in that, but it raised a question for me. How much of my life is scheduled? How much of my life is so overcommitted to so many things that I'm missing these moments of openness to God's Spirit, of openness to creativity and to something wildly new and extravagant? Linda and I have caught a few episodes of a PBS series, an NPR series called, PBS, I guess, it's called Doc Martin. It's not about the shoes. It's the adventures of a doctor in a small village in southwestern England, Doc Martin. And he's a good guy, and he's really a great doctor, but he's kind of a bumbler when it comes to personal relationships. Not really great, what you call bedside manner. And so in one of the episodes, he and the local school principal, Louisa, they've helped save the life of a young boy. And they're on their way back in a taxi. Both of them are single, and you can tell from this that even though they have that kind of British reserve, that they have this kind of fondness for each other. Well, in the back seat of the taxi, their hands accidentally touch each other. And so Louisa takes this as an opportunity to throw herself on Doc Martin and kiss him passionately. So the kiss ends, and they are looking lovingly at each other. And Martin says, I'm assuming you have a regular dental hygiene. Okay, things not to say, right? Okay. And she says, well, obviously not in the last few hours where they're rescuing this child, but thank you very much. Yes, I have. He persists. Well, that would suggest rhinosinusitis or gastroesophageal reflux. Are you saying I have bad breath? Well, I just think it would be wise to rule out any infection of the aerodigestive tract. Obviously, a dietary explanation would be the happiest outcome. The scene ends with the taxi stopping in the middle of the road. A door swings open. Doc Martin unceremoniously dumped at the side of the road. There's a time, friends, for analysis and for calculation, right? And then there is a time for throwing analysis out the window and paying attention to that abundant heart. Amen? Amen? So back in the season of Lent, we're in the season of Easter now, but back in Lent, many of us decided in this church that we would take some small steps to follow Jesus. And so one family who volunteers at Open Door shared with me that they were kind of keeping their ears open. And what they heard was, do you have any chocolate milk? That's what they heard from the guests. And we didn't. At first they thought it might be a bit silly to bring chocolate milk to Open Door. This is a meal that we, like a nice brunch that we do for about, some of you have volunteered in it, right? about 200 to 250 people, mostly who are experiencing homelessness and poverty, and they come up to our fellowship hall every Saturday. And we have volunteers, so we a meal, and we give clothing to them and all this stuff. So Open Door. So they're hearing this about chocolate milk, and they're thinking, maybe it's a little bit silly or frivolous to bring chocolate milk to Open Door. And then one Sunday, they were listening to the children's sermon, everyone's favorite part of the worship service, right? And someone said that we should all do something good, even a small thing, like maybe bringing the senior pastor chocolate. And so now when they come to Open Door, they bring chocolate milk. And they bring tangerines for their new friends. And our guests love it. Listen to Paul Tillich again. Do not suppress in yourselves the abundant heart, the waste of self-surrender. Keep yourselves open for the creative moment. Do not suppress the impulse to do what Mary did at Bethany. You will be reproached as she was. But Jesus was on her side, and he is also on yours. Without the abundance of the heart, nothing great will happen. Can you picture this? Our congregation, every single one of us here today, doing some small thing with great love, with abandon for those who are in poverty, for those who are in homelessness, who will, by the way, always be with us, because we will always be with them. What a waste. What a magnificent holy waste. Amen? Amen. Thanks be to God. Amen.